Well, welcome to Midweek as we continue in our 66-24, and that is studying 66 books of the Bible over 24 Wednesday evenings. If you have not already done so, you can pick up in the back an outline that gives you an overview, actually a narrative overview on page number one, and then an outline of the book of Exodus, which is our second book of study, on page two. Let me give you a little bit of an overview of several other things tonight before we specifically get into the book of Exodus. And the first item relates not specifically at all to either the Old Testament or the book of Exodus, and that is a project that I have been working on for several years, but most significantly and with lots of time and intensity in the year 2004, is a new book that is called Jesus, is the title of the book, and the expanded title is An Intimate Portrait of the Man, His Land, and His People. It is about 400 pages in length, and it is a biography of Jesus Christ. And what the book does is take the information in the four Gospels and includes all of that information, but melds them together into a single story and does it in a way that is set up like a biography. So it's different than what you would normally find if you were to simply read sequentially Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The book also incorporates a great deal of historical and geographical and cultural explanations of what was going on and why, and that's done both in the text of the book, but in a series of sidebars and side notes that are woven in as well. And they explain things like the Lake of Galilee, or the depth of the Dead Sea, or Hanukkah. Hanukkah, of course, is mentioned only in the New Testament and not in the Old Testament. Anyway, all of that is to say that the book is to be released here in February, and not here, across America in February, and the publishers, the publisher specifically and CEO, Bethany House Publishing Company, suggested to me this past week that it would be a good thing at the beginning of what is, we think, a significant project and unlike anything else that's ever been done on the life of Jesus, to have an opportunity for prayer and for a dedication of this volume. And Gary Johnson had suggested that we invite some people from Bethany House Publishers and some elders and pastors of Wooddale Church to do that. And I suggested that some of you may want to be included in this. So we are going to do this after the conclusion of this midweek class tonight. So when we finish, if you want to, you can come up and feel the book. And it'll just be 10 minutes or so. And Pat Mazeroff from our elder board, Gary Johnson from Bethany House Publishers, and Ken Geist from the pastoral staff of Wooddale Church will be the ones that will lead in this time of prayer and dedication. Also here this evening is Carol Johnson, who has been the editor of the Jesus book. So we will conclude by 8:05 or so, and if you want to go, you're welcome to, but if you're interested in staying, you may do that. The other additional feature is, at the end of our study of Exodus tonight, we're going to have a five-minute video clip that is... Actually, I had invited Tim Mahoney, who is a member of Wooddale Church, to be here tonight, and he's out of town, out west, at a trade show presenting a film that he has been working on the Exodus, and it is just this major project. He has made multiple trips to the Middle East, to Egypt, to Saudi Arabia, to Europe, and interviewed a multitude of scholars, and is at this very time, tonight, meeting with people from the Discovery Channel and the History Channel and PBS to find out who is interested in purchasing and then airing this film. So what you will see is a five-minute clip and overview, and what it presents is an alternative view of the root of the Exodus. So there has been several traditional routes, and if you have a study Bible that has maps, you may either have a route that is shown there, or as in a Bible that I was looking at today, it shows different alternatives. But what Tim and the scholars that he has been working with are proposing is a very different route of the Exodus and a very different understanding than what most of us have read and been taught about the Red Sea, or sometimes called the Reed Sea. So with all of that, let's start into the book of Exodus. And you recall from where we were talking last week that there are five books, Pentateuch, five books in Greek, that are called the books of Moses, or the Torah, or the law, and that Moses is credited with the writing of all of them. And in the New Testament, they are referred to as a group. And while there is nothing in Genesis that specifically says that Moses wrote Genesis, and there are no direct quotes out of Genesis attributed to Jesus or attributed to Moses in the New Testament, that is not the case with Exodus. So within the book of Exodus, there are specific mentions of Moses being not the writer of the whole book, but of God instructing him to write these things down. So we'll operate on the general assumption, which is the long tradition, that Moses is the author of this second book of the Bible. And Exodus means exactly what it says, and we've got signs over our doors here that say exit. And we could just as well have called it Exodus, because that's what it means. Exodus means exit or departure. While that is certainly a major part of the story of the book that bears that name, there is a sense in which that's not really what the book is about. What the book is really about is how Israel became a nation. And the Exodus is part of that nation-building story. So what we have is the end of the book of Genesis, where there are 100 or so people that have come now to live in Egypt rather than in the promised land that was offered to Abraham. And they are there as guests in the midst of famine with one of their own, Joseph, the second in charge of the country. However, by the time we turn the page out of the end of Genesis into the beginning of Exodus, there is a very large number of people, and there are different estimates, but generally the estimates are in the vicinity of 1 or 2 million people. Some would say less, some would say more, but the significant point is that it is an enormous increase over the small family clan or cluster that was initially the people of Israel. By the time the book of Exodus begins, Joseph has been forgotten. Nobody much remembers anything about him. Certainly the Egyptians don't. And the Pharaoh, who showed such special favor to Joseph and to his family, has also long been forgotten. Now what the Egyptians have is not 100 people who are hungry, but a couple of million people who are threatening. So they're looking at this different ethnic, linguistic, religious group that is in Lower Egypt, lower not in terms of the map, but lower in terms of geography, on the north of Egypt, the land of Goshen. And these people are multiplying rapidly. And the fear of the Pharaoh is that they will usurp his authority, that there will be a coup d'etat that will overthrow him and overthrow the empire. So he orders the murder of all of the Hebrew baby boys. And it becomes just one of the first of a very long list of historic occasions when people have, to a greater or lesser extent, attempted genocide against those who are Jews. You know some of the atrocities of World War II that have been attacks against Jews. One of the stories that's told in the Jesus book is about what happened under the rule of a man named Antiochus IV, who was the king of Syria and over the land of Canaan in the 2nd century B.C. He tried to eradicate Jewish religion and culture. And he, for example, following a page from Pharaoh, ordered that no Jewish boys could be circumcised. And to show you the animosity that he had toward them, what he did when he found out that a baby had been circumcised was that he would publicly crucify the mother with her baby around her neck. Now, that's the kind of behavior that Pharaoh was exercising, a different expression than what Antiochus did. Or maybe you have heard this week that 20 members of the Duma, the parliament of Russia, have signed a 7-page letter requesting that Russian law now prohibit all Jewish associations, meetings, organizations, and religious gatherings in the nation of Russia. And what we have is a continuous trend that is paralleled by God's preserving of his people. So let's look at Exodus chapter 1, and it gives us the mood and then the setting of the story. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. But the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so that the land was filled with them. Then a new king who did not know about Joseph came to power in Egypt. "Look," he said to the people, "the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, "When you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live." The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive." So God was kind to the midwives for lying, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people: "Every boy that is born you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live." Well, it is out of that setting that we move into the story of Moses. And the birth of Moses in chapter 2 introduces probably one of the top handful of all of the greatest leaders and lawgivers in all of the history of the human race. He was an absolutely extraordinary man. And from the time of his birth, his mother sensed that he was special. And like other of the Hebrew women, she defied the law, defied the Pharaoh, and hid him. But as he grew bigger, she realized that this was something she could not continue to conceal. And so, in a plan that probably really didn't have a rational destination to it, she took a papyrus basket and placed her child Moses in it and set it in one of the areas of the Nile River where there probably wasn't much of a flow and where reeds were growing, and happened to choose a place where women from the royal court would come to bathe in the Nile. And one of those women was the daughter of Pharaoh. And she saw this baby in the papyrus basket, and she liked him. She was attracted to him. And so with royal authority, she sort of claimed this child. But the child had not yet been weaned and needed to be nursed. And so she's sort of looking around saying, you know, who are we going to hire to do this? And standing not far away was Miriam, who was Moses' older sister. And she said, well, I know somebody who might be available to do this. And Pharaoh's daughter, or at least through the servants of Pharaoh's daughter, said, who is that? And Miriam went and got her mother. And so Moses' own mother was then hired by the royal family in order to raise her own child. So for those who are making parallels to welfare systems, she certainly was a mother who was supported by the government in order to raise her own child. And he was named Moses, which meant to draw out, or at least it is a word that sounds like the word for draw out. And Moses' mother cared for him initially, but Pharaoh's daughter was serious about this, and as he grew somewhat older, she claimed him and brought him into the palace, where he then grew up as an Egyptian and as the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now, we have a tendency to look at other times and cultures as primitive by comparison to our own, but on the expansive scale of things, the Egyptians were amazingly sophisticated. They were advanced compared to other societies in medicine, in understanding of physiology, in a written language, in terms of music and culture, and certainly in terms of architecture. I remember the first time that we visited Egypt and we were climbing up and crawling around the pyramids. And the inevitable question was, how did those people possibly get these stones in place? And he went through all of these theories and then basically concluded by saying, we really don't know how they did it. And it would be an enormous, if not an impossible, task with modern construction equipment, but how they pulled something like this off is truly an amazing feat. So he grew up for 40 years speaking the Egyptian language, experiencing the Egyptian culture, learning to read and write, unlike probably what most of the rest of the Hebrew people had. He had enormous privilege. But as he reached around his 40th birthday and remembered what his mother had taught him in infancy, he decided instead to identify with his own people. And that, you know, that's really amazing that he made that choice to do that. And one of the first things that he did was intended to express compassion, but enormously backfired. He went probably with royal clothing on to check out what was happening among these enslaved people, and he saw an Egyptian taskmaster beating an Israelite slave. And he intervened and he murdered the Egyptian taskmaster. He thought that no one saw it, but it wasn't long until he tried to intervene again. This time it was a fight between two Hebrew men, and when he went to intervene, they said, you mean you're going to do to us what you did to the taskmaster? You're going to kill one of us? And suddenly Moses realized that he couldn't keep the secret. And fearful that his adopted grandfather would now turn against him, he decided that he needed to flee. And so he escaped from Egypt a long way to the land of Midian, which is in all probability what today we would call Saudi Arabia. And he lived there for the next 40 years of his life. Actually, Moses' life is divisible into three sections of 40 years each. And during those 40 years, he met a family that was headed by a man named Jethro, who had a daughter named Zipporah. And he married Zipporah and had two sons by her. And he was a goat herder out in a very barren part of the Middle East. And that was enormously humbling. Why? He was from the court of Pharaoh, the most powerful emperor in the world. And now he's out with goats with nobody to talk to and in an extremely remote place. And that represented the next 40 years. So now we encounter Moses as an 80-year-old man who one day out in the wilderness sees a bush on fire, maybe comparable to what we would think of as tumbleweed in Wyoming or in parts of Colorado or Montana. And not that that was a terribly unusual thing or a particularly dangerous thing. It wasn't like the whole desert was going to burn down. But what was unusual and caught his attention is that what should have just been a puff of fire was a continuous fire. So while the bush was on fire, it wasn't consumed. And he went over to it, and the bush talked to him. Now, anytime you have a bush that doesn't burn and talks to you, you really want to put down what you're doing and give some extra attention to this for a few minutes. And the bush, or at least the voice that comes from the bush, tells him that he has come to holy ground and he needs to de-sandal and he needs to stand there barefoot as a symbol of the significance of where he is. And he has a conversation, at first not realizing who he was talking to, with God himself. And he asks God who he is. What's your name? And God speaks his name. Now, in older translations of the Bible, it has been translated as Jehovah. It's kind of an interesting word because the Jews never actually pronounced this word. It was considered too holy. We think today it probably was pronounced, if pronounced, more like this, Yahweh. And it is called a tetragrammaton from the number of letters that are there. But what it is, it's sort of a play on words. It is a use of the Hebrew state of being verb, and it's sometimes translated in different ways depending on what you do with the verb tenses that are there, but roughly means something like, I am that I am. So, who are you? I am that I am. And the whole concept of I am, the presence of the present God who has eternity about him, and whose son later on comes and says, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the light, I am the bread of life. And do not think that that escaped the people of his generation, that he used the name of God in describing his name, who he in fact is. Well, anyway, he gets into a conversation with Yahweh, who has a new job assignment for him, and that is to go back to Egypt and to set his people free. And Moses says, well, I can't do that. And he had a whole lot of reasons why it was a bad assignment. And one of them was, I don't talk very well. I'm not a good talker. And we don't actually know what this means. It may have simply been an excuse. He may have had a speech impediment. But up until that time, there was no indication that he had trouble talking, and he would have spoken without accent the language of the Egyptians. But whatever excuse he came up with, God had an answer for it. And God's answer was, okay, you have a brother named Aaron. He's a good talker. You tell him what to say and let him do the talking for you. And Moses is doubting that this God really has the power to pull this off. So Yahweh says to him, what have you got in your hand? And he's got a stick in his hand, and he says, throw it on the ground. He throws it on the ground, and it turns into a snake. So it's an amazing miracle. Now, I would have done that, but when he told him to pick it up again, I would have had some reservations. But he grabs the snake, and it stiffens up, and it's back to a stick again. And then Yahweh says to him, tell you what, take your hand and put it inside your clothes. So Napoleon-like, he puts his hand in. He says, now take it out and look at it. And he takes it out, and it's covered with leprosy. It's completely white. And when Yahweh says, put it back, now I would have done that, put it back in, and then take it out again, and it's fine. It's healed. So he's met up with God himself, but this is the very beginning of this new experience and encounter that he is having. But he says yes, and he returns to Egypt after a 40-year absence. For those of you that are old enough to have been 40 years away from the place that you grew up and then went back to see what it was like, you discover that it is no longer as you remember it to be, that buildings have changed and other people are 40 years older, even if you don't think that you are, and it is a somewhat different world. But he goes back, and amazingly, at least in my observation, he gains access to the court of Pharaoh himself. And maybe sometimes speaking directly or most often through Aaron, he goes and says to Pharaoh, let my people go. And Pharaoh says, uh-uh, no, they're not going anywhere. And then there is an escalating controversy. It starts out, oh, by the way, I should back up to say, to Moses' probable surprise, since he left in bad relationships, he was pretty well received by the leaders of the people of Israel. So he goes as their spokesperson to Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, no, I'm not going to let the people go. And if your people have so much free time that they want to go and worship their God somewhere outside of Egypt, then I think that they need to have more assignments. And the next assignment was, remember, they're already being treated ruthlessly. Their next assignment was that in their brick-making responsibilities, they no longer have straw to use. Well, it's the straw that held the brick together when it was baked. And so now they've got to go and scrounge up anything that they can put into the brick so that it will hold together. And the quotas are increasingly multiplied. And the people are not better off because of Moses and Yahweh. They are worse off than they were before. Moses, in appearing before Pharaoh, tries the snake going into a, or the stick going into a snake trick, and he thought that was really impressive. But then he discovers that Pharaoh wants the magicians of his court to do the same thing, and they do. And there's a powerful lesson there that the abilities of Satan are often leveled against the miracles of God. And actually, there can be false miracles that are done. Well, what we then next have is a series of escalations. The miracles get bigger and bigger, and they become plagues that are actually worse and worse.